Hi there, it's Julia Louis-Dreyfus. You may know me from my podcast called Wiser Than Me, where I talk to older women and get their wisdom from the front lines of life. I was amazed by how many people told me our show made them look forward to getting older, which is why I'm here to talk about season two of the show. Sally Field, Billie Jean King, Beverly Johnson, Ina Garten, Bonnie Raitt, just to name a few. All hail old women. Wiser Than Me season two is out now from Lemonada Media.
And welcome to Boarding Party. I am Jackie Jennings, and I have a pretty crazy fact for you. Just try and believe it, but I don't know if you'll be able to. Most comedians are also geeks. It's true. They're geeks. And on Boarding Party, we're going to talk to some of today's funniest people about their secret, and sometimes not so secret, genre obsessions. If it's horror, fantasy, sci-fi, comics, anything that falls under that umbrella of making you a big geek, we're going to be talking to funny people about it. And today, our guest is Connor Ratliff. So Connor is, in addition to being my friend, a performer, which is the most important credit, he's a performer at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater on the legendary improv team, The Stepfathers. He's also played Chester on The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel. He was Ted on Search Party. He's been on The Chris Gethard Show many times. And most importantly, for our purposes here today, he's got a long-running show, I believe it's 5 years, at the UCB called The George Lucas Talk Show, where once a month he hosts a late-night talk show as George Lucas. So I'm going to be talking to Connor about Star Wars, George Lucas, maybe some other stuff. I don't know. We'll see. Connor Ratliff.
Hello.
I'm so excited that you're doing this. You're here. We're going to talk about, I think, number one topic. Well, first, let me ask you, do you consider yourself a nerd slash geek?
I think so, but I feel like I'm to the fringe of that. Like, I feel like there's probably another word. I think there's enough things that I'm not nerdy about. I definitely feel like I'm in that's the broad umbrella that I fall under.
Like, you meant you were like the fringe of what is already like you were geek beyond geek.
I don't know. Not in a better way. Not in terms of a superior way. Okay. I just feel like if you got a bunch of nerds in a room and you put me in there with them, I feel like there'd be things where it's like, oh, I don't know what you guys are talking about. And then I would start talking about a thing. And then three of those people would be like, that's what we like too. And we would go off to the side. I feel like I'm a nerd within nerddom.
I do know what you mean. I was, in prepping for this, was thinking about like what other, which we will get to, other than Star Wars and George Lucas talk show, the things I know about you.
Yeah.
And your, I'm going to say aesthetic, which is, I know you, the midnight screenings.
Mm-hmm.
Is it fair to say you're a Muppets fan?
Yes.
Yes.
Up till the point where Jim Henson perishes.
Where Jim Henson dies.
Yeah.
Okay. In real life, that's not Muppets canon that he appears and then dies.
No, yes.
Okay.
It's more just I'm a purist about original voices of Muppet characters. And once you have a replacement voice, I kind of don't acknowledge that as a – for me, it's not Kermit the Frog if it's not Jim Henson doing the voice.
When did that stop? When did he die?
He died, I want to say like 89. I could be wrong about that. It might have been 90, but I think it was around – between 89 and 91, I'm blanking on the exact year.
So that strikes me as a very limited amount of time that the Muppets.
Yeah, it's 2 decades, basically, more or less. 20 years of Muppets.
Okay.
But there's a lot of Muppets during those 2 decades. You have the Muppet movie trilogy happens during that. You have the Muppet show. You have all these original things. And then you have a bunch of weird offshoots. And, you know, like the Muppet Family Christmas is probably the end of the line for me in terms of major Muppet projects.
Okay.
And then after that, you know, if I see a Frank Oz, like there's a great clip on YouTube of Frank Oz as Cookie Monster with Martha Stewart.
You know what me give you if you give me Cookie?
What will you give me?
Me got nothing to give you, please. Please. Please, Martha.
Certain characters that are so defined by an actor that it's hard to, I don't think the Muppets are like James Bond where just anybody can play the role.
Yeah.
I think that like a character like Bert and Ernie, that's Jim Henson and Frank Oz to the point where, you know, like nobody goes and sees like a Beatles tribute concert and says like, those are the Beatles. No matter how good it is, nobody says, like, I saw the Beatles. Like, no, you saw some very talented people doing a very good show.
I can't put my finger on why I don't entirely agree with you on that.
It's probably generational. It probably is, yeah. Like, you. Some of your earliest Muppet experiences were probably replacement Muppets.
Yes.
So it doesn't matter as much.
Whereas
I had an awareness that when Jim Henson died, the next time I heard Kermit the Frog, I was like, ooh. Like, Muppet Christmas Carol, I think it was the next time. I'm like, it sounds close.
There was something sticky for you there. It was like
if you knew someone and you cared about them and then they were suddenly gone and someone was doing an excellent impression of them, you just have that sense of disconnect of, like, you're not.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I wonder if it's, I mean, we can go back to the list, but I do wonder if it's, because I'm thinking of shows where actors have died or just been entirely recast. It's never been addressed. It's happened in major shows.
Yeah.
Game of Thrones did it, where it was just an entirely different
Dario
Naharis. It is weird at first, but then you don't care. I wonder if there's something about knowing that it's not their creation, that it is just a performance. But with the Muppets, there is something like inherent to,
And it bothers me. Like I love Game of Thrones, and it bothered me when they'd switch actors. But it also depends on the character, because I will accept it for the characters they've done it with in a way that I wouldn't have suddenly, like, Tyrion was a new.
Yes.
You know, there are just characters where you'd be like, I don't want to watch this anymore.
We need to talk about this.
If halfway through the first season, Ned Stark started being played by a different actor, you'd just be like, this isn't cool, man.
I will end this tangent, but last night on a plane home, I watched The Martian. Have you seen The Martian?
Yes, I have.
Okay. There is a conversation that they are having. An irrelevant conversation. I mean, almost every scene that's not on Mars does not matter in my opinion.
Yeah.
Someone gets a text about Project Elrond while Sean Bean is in the room, mm-hmm. who plays obviously Boromir and they have this conversation like, what's Elrond?
The Council of Elrond is from Lord of the Rings. It's the meeting where they decide to destroy the One Ring.
I'm going to call something Project Elrond. I would like my code name to be Glorfindel.
I hate every one of you.
It blew my mind how bizarre a choice it was.
Yeah, because that's not—it's not that kind of movie.
No,
like if that happened on an episode of Arrested Development, it would be an intentional joke.
Yes, and it would be great.
But The Martian—I don't remember that scene because I don't remember the Maybe that's what got it the Golden Globe nomination for Best Comedy or Musical.
It is. It's funny.
Like, I don't remember. I barely remember the scenes that aren't on Mars in that movie.
Exactly. And there's a lot of them. The thing that I feel like I most closely associate with you and genre is obviously Star Wars and the George Lucas talk show.
Yes.
Yes.
I don't think it's hard to know what is a Star Wars nerd or what is a Star Wars fan in 2019, because it's, for a while I had a realization that I really don't have, I wouldn't classify myself if someone was like, oh, you're a major Star Wars nerd. I'd be like, I don't think so, because really I like the Han Solo movies a lot.
Mm.
And I enjoy the new movies that are out, but I've never read a Star Wars novel. I don't play the games. There's so much in the world of Star Wars that I don't have any connection to, that I really feel like I have a limited sphere of things that I like, and it's mostly the movies. I like the movies, you know.
Yeah, I mean, those are the sort big of things.
Like, yeah, that's the reason for it. Whereas I feel like a real Star Wars fan is like immersed in every form of media that they, you know.
Yeah, well, I do feel like it is that sort of like fandoms, especially in sci-fi fantasy, can feel exclusive if you're not completely immersed in every form of media.
Yeah.
And there is a word for it, I'm forgetting, a very specific type of fan that can intentionally make you feel like, well, if you haven't read, you know, X, Y, and Z, then that one-upsmanship. But the George Lucas talk show specifically, just it's a show at the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater.
Yes.
Where you play George Lucas.
I pretend to be George Lucas, retired filmmaker George Lucas.
Does he call himself retired?
I introduce myself as retired filmmaker George Lucas.
I actually have
at the beginning of the show, if you come see it, there's a bit of audio that was taken from a show, and I don't even think the original audio even aired.
Mm-hmm.
I hosted an episode when CISO existed. I hosted an episode of the UCB show as George Lucas. They asked me if I would like host a show in character.
That's very funny.
So I have a bit of audio of Amy Poehler saying, "Please welcome retired filmmaker George Lucas." And once I got, I was given access to this audio. And once I got it, I'm like, I'm playing this every month at the show. Like, no one else will introduce me. It'll just be this snippet of Amy Poehler saying, "Please welcome retired filmmaker George Lucas."
Oh, at what point do you think he retired? Would you say it's like immediately after Empire wrapped? he was retired.
No, he's got a whole trilogy of movies after that. No, I mean, I started doing the show sort of right around the time that he did. And, you know, like he sold the everything to Disney and he retired.
Yeah.
And became what he thought was going to be, I think, a consulting role, even though no one has really consulted with him since.
No.
And
no one has consulted with him since.
Well, they let him consult a little, I think, on Solo. He contributed a joke to Solo. But I think otherwise he's been pretty well shut out. It was actually... we had John Kasdan was on the show last month, and he told the story, which he's told elsewhere, about how, because, you know, Ron Howard's directing that, and so it's all, it was a friendly space for George to drop by and take a look.
How could it not be? Yeah. That's so upsetting.
And there was a scene where they're in Lando's, like, cloakroom, like his cape closet.
Yes.
And Alden Ehrenreich, as Han Solo, like, grabbed this cloak, and he, like, put it back up on the hanger. And apparently George was at the side and he was like, "Han wouldn't do that." And they're like, "What?" And he's like, "Han wouldn't hang it back up. He'd throw it on the floor. He'd just drop it." And so they like went over and they were like, "George says that Han shouldn't hang the cape up again." So
is
he just kind of lets
joke?
It.
It's very generous to call that a joke.
I think that's a joke.
And not just a piece of direction.
It's a little bit of business. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's a little fun
yeah.
bit of business.
It's a little physical comedy.
It's a little bit of character work because if you think about it, you might not notice it, but if you're watching the movie and you see Han Solo carefully hang up Lando's cape,
yeah.
it doesn't read. That doesn't scan as the
no,
character.
It doesn't.
He doesn't care what happens to Lando's capes.
Yeah.
But I started doing this character really back in college. I would just do it with my friends. And it was around the time that, like, Lucas, you know, he'd sort of been, Star Wars had gone away for a while.
Mm-hmm.
And then Lucas started gearing up to make new Star Wars movies by doing the special editions. A lot of the special editions were, you know, nice, you know, let's clean up this little matte line here. Let's fix this effect so it's not so, you know, noticeably of its time.
Mm-hmm.
Every piece of new content that was in the special editions was not great. I mean, it was there were things that I was looking at. I was thinking like, oh, I don't like these new editions. Some of them were a little silly.
That's what stuck out to me is the creatures.
There were a lot of the things that like beeped and blorped and
yes.
and they seemed a little jokey in a way that didn't feel the same to me.
Yeah.
And rather than getting mad about it, which I think is a default, it's a fan reaction that I don't like a lot, which is that fans getting angry about, like, I always feel like if you're angry about something that you don't like in Star Wars, unless it's, like, hateful, unless it's something you perceive as, like, hateful
sure.
or offensive, if it's just that you don't like it aesthetically, I think it's fine to feel that level – it's fine to feel passionately about it.
Uh-huh.
But the second it goes over into kind of, like, anger or sorrow – you've invested unwisely.
I tend to agree. The line for me is blurry for my, the minute it's like, you can't put this down, this argument.
Yes.
And say, but also it's a fun movie and whatever.
If you're having fun, then you're not really angry. Like if you're like, here's what I think stupid and I'm making fun of it or something. That's one thing.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, there's some genuine rage that to me points to a need to talk to someone to just figure out what it is you're really angry about. Because it's not a made-up world of aliens that you're angry about.
No, it can't be.
I think the people who make Last Jedi reaction videos that are really, really suffering.
Yes. And there's a level, too, of like, I think there's a difference between you and I having a conversation where we disagree or one of us feels passionately about what good storytelling is versus someone who put effort into the anger that they feel over blue milk.
Yes.
You've got to stop. The minute you're involving equipment in your anger, that might be a generally good rule. When there's equipment involved in expressing your anger, you've got to pause.
If it's making you feel that badly.
Yes.
I don't believe that it any longer has anything to do with the sci-fi thing that you're mad about.
No,
I think it is like you're not happy with where your life is. You need to figure it out.
Yeah, there's yes.
And really, my 90s experience where I started doing the George Lucas character was really like I realized like we're gonna need a coping mechanism because there's some Star Wars movies coming up, and if they're like what the new material in the special editions is like. We're gonna feel that.
So you knew. You sort of.
I knew.
You looked.
I 100% knew.
You looked at those little CGI creatures in Mos Eisley, and you were like, "This, what's coming, won't be." It was sort of yes.
It wasn't good. Yeah, because the thing is, if you'd asked me in 1992, mm-hmm. what do I think the new Star Wars are gonna be like when they get made, if they get made, I would have been like, they're gonna be great.
Yeah, phenomenal.
And then I would watch like the new Jabba scene or Greedo shooting first or things like that, and I started to realize. Oh, if they're made with that, if that is the mentality of what's being made, these movies won't fully be for me.
Yeah, we have a problem. There are some problems.
And so I started doing a version of George Lucas where like my friends would sort of interview me just conversationally, in any context. Sometimes someone would be like, so George, what are you? And I would talk about, oh, we're just going to have one actor play all the parts and we can fix it in digitally. And I actually had this character who was just a custodian at ILM. And he was going to play all the roles in the new Star Wars movie, and they would just fix it digitally. It was just this guy who was like, yeah, I'm playing all parts. And he would do Darth Vader, and he'd be like, ho, ho, I'm your father, Luke. Ho, ho. and that was meant to be the breathing. The ho was him going, ho, ho. And so I talk about, yeah, we're just going to film him on a green screen, and then we'll fix it later.
We'll figure it out.
And
can so change anything.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. It's all ones and zeros. And, you know. And so by the time Phantom Menace came out, you know, there were all these news stories about like grown men waiting in line for a month to see the movie. And then they come out and they're just like, I wasted my childhood, you know. And for me, like I knew when I saw Phantom Menace that at least 50% of the movie didn't work on any level for me. But there was a lot of it that I was able to enjoy the parts of it that felt like Star Wars to me. Because there are lots of parts in that first movie, Phantom Menace, that look and feel like Star Wars. They are often then followed by things that feel and look nothing like what I would think of as Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
By the time you got to Attack of the Clones, most of those things have been stripped out. I don't find very much in that movie at all.
There's not much.
That to me, Attack of the Clones still feels like, it still feels like a like very ambitious syndicated TV show of that time.
Such an indictment, but I completely agree.
And then by the third one, I don't even think I saw it on the weekend it came out, which was sort of like,
no.
I realized, oh, I've disinvested from a lot of this.
Yeah.
But I never got mad about it because to me, like George Lucas had already more than made enough things in my lifetime that gave me so much pleasure that the idea that I would ever be angry because he then made other ones that weren't satisfying to me. It's just like, well, those ones weren't satisfying to me, but he'd already.
You could give him sort of a special dispensation because he'd so satisfied you with other films of his that he has a lifetime pass, would you say?
Yeah, and I think that's true. That's generally my philosophy for a lot of artists, which is like I'm amazed how people get so angry when an artist starts to let them down, especially when it's just their. They're still trying. Like, I don't think there's any lack of effort in the Star Wars prequels. They just don't land for me.
The issue that I would take with the prequels is they, and I've said this before, I don't think it's like a stunning observation, but they feel like what happens when someone isn't told no. It feels like unchecked sort of, I don't even want to say creative freedom, just freedom.
I agree completely. I think it's a cautionary tale. The interesting thing is, so I started doing the George Lucas talk show a few years ago, and I think me doing the George Lucas character has been such a healthy way of processing both my admiration for him and the things that he's done that have been unsatisfying.
So I do want to ask, like, what, when you are doing George Lucas, when you came up with the idea for the show, how much of it is admiration? How much of it is whatever the opposite of admiration is, but isn't dislike? Is it because you're a fan? Is it because you find so much about him to be sort of silly and over the top? Or is it both?
It's both, but if I had to pick one, it's more admiration than anything negative, because if I think of the people that I truly have a negative opinion of, I don't think I would be doing the show, because I think I would do like three shows and then be like, okay, we've done this.
Yeah. It doesn't feel good or fun.
Yeah. I think part of the reason, one thing is that it's inherently funny to me, the idea that George Lucas would host a talk show, because, you know, notoriously, you know, he's a behind the scenes guy. This is not a guy. If you look up, there's a YouTube video I looked up recently. It was, if you look up George Lucas inspirational speech, there's like him giving a speech, and it's just like, the guy's not a speaker, you know, like he's up and he's like, well, we knew the power of storytelling is, and you're just like, I don't really do like, I mean, you've been on the show, like the first 10 seconds I'm doing a sort of a hard impression of him, you know, I'll come out, I'll run out into the theater, I'll high five the audience, and then I'll get on stage, and then I'll take a long beat and then say, hello, I'm George Lucas, creator of Star Wars. And it's such like an anticlimactic way of starting the show. And oftentimes, a few minutes into the show, I will no longer even be doing the voice. I'll be kind of leaning into it every now and then, in part because it's not like, it's not a performative voice. You know, he's not a performer in that way.
Yeah.
So there was something funny about that. The other thing that I thought was that there's sort of a, I like to have a fail-safe sort of for if, sometimes the show's going well because I'm doing a good job hosting a comedy talk show, and I'm doing a good job of sort of balancing the conversation and making sure everyone's getting a chance to talk.
And we should say you have on real guests.
Yes, real guests.
They're not characters. They're
mostly not Star Wars-related guests.
Yeah.
The ideal guest in some ways is a person who has nothing, no connection to Star Wars, and I will find a way of relating to them as George Lucas in a way that makes it that I will find the link to Lucas.
Yeah.
Because
six degrees,
almost always is one, you know, that like, we did the show in LA a couple years ago, and I convinced Amy Mann to come on the show because I'm a huge Amy Mann fan.
Oh, yeah. I remember seeing that poster and being like, that's cool.
Yeah. And she was reluctant because she kept saying to me, like, I don't know anything about Star Wars. I'd be a terrible guest. And I'll be like, don't you worry about that. You just need to be yourself.
Just show up.
The show started and she came out up front. She sort of outed herself and said, like, I shouldn't be here. I don't know anything about Star Wars. I've never seen a Star Wars movie. And I said, have you ever seen American Graffiti? And she goes, oh yeah, I love that movie. I'm like, great. Let's talk about that.
Yeah. George Lucas. Wonderful.
And then I was like talking about things like, how we were both Oscar losers. We'd both been nominated for Oscars and lost.
Oh, she for him, song.
Him for Star Wars, her for Save Me from Magnolia. Yes, she lost to Phil Collins for Tarzan.
Wow, that's a real moment in time.
And so, like, I'm bringing up as Lucas, I'm like, of course, I won a Thalberg, but that's just an honorary Oscar, you know? And then I was also bringing up the fact that, like, we both had the same, we both pulled away from, like, the studio. I pulled away from the studio system the same way that she pulled away from the major record labels and started her own thing.
Great.
So we were talking about, like, there were so many connections.
Yeah.
For things to talk about that were just purely, and so I'm always looking for, like, what is that connection, you know? The more surprising, the better. Like, I kept doing that same thing. Ira Glass was on the show, and I kept saying, you and I are basically the same. We've done all the same jobs. And he's like, what are you talking about? And I'm like, we both worked in public radio. And he's like, what are you? And I'm like, remember when NPR did the Star Wars radio dramas? And he was like, oh, yeah. And, you know, I kept bringing up, like, different things.
I mean, that tracks to me. That doesn't seem insane that Ira Glass and George Lucas would be pretty similar.
Yeah, these are, you know, but I do think, like, one of the things that fascinates me about Lucas as a comedic character is that he's one of the most successful people of all time. But he's also kind of known for all these huge failures.
Yes.
And a lot of those failures are also tremendously successful by a lot of metrics.
They're still,
Howard the Duck is one of the most notorious bombs of all time. It's also the first Marvel movie.
Yeah, and it's beloved. People love that movie.
And
ironically, but they love it.
Yeah, it's become the cult classic that he said it would be. And there's an interesting thing to me, which is that, like, as I've done the show, because I probably, if you go back and find, like, the first couple of shows we did, some of those are on YouTube, I think I have a slightly more cynical take on Lucas at that point, because I'm sort of going for the easier jokes of
him being proud of everything he's done and some of those things not being great.
Is he like notoriously proud?
It feels like it. I don't know how much of that is but it seems like
he's never apologized for Attack of the Clones. He's never said that was a stinker.
He's
not
like one of those filmmakers who you hear him badmouthing his past work. I think it's just a trait that he's like, you know, he either doesn't talk about them or he says nice things about things he's done.
Mm-hmm.
What I came to realize, and partly it's because as the character, you know, a lot of times guests will come on and they'll want to be combative and kind of call me on like, you did this and it wasn't good. And so I've gotten a lot of experience now defending Lucas from any sort of criticism. You know, like once, you know, one of the common things that happens that's such an easy joke, and I don't plan for it, but it just happens a lot, was I'll ask a guest what their favorite Star Wars movie is, and they'll say the first one, and I'll immediately say, like, oh, Phantom Menace, thank you very much. You know, that you can always play with. If they say the fourth one, then I can say, oh, Phantom Menace, the fourth one we made, thank you very much. You know,
it can always be the Phantom Menace.
Yeah.
Okay, before we dive any deeper, before we go any further, we have to take a quick break.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Here's another thing, and this goes to what you're saying before about people saying no, which is Lucas's early career is he makes American Graffiti.
Mm-hmm.
The head of Universal hates the movie. It's finished. It's finished. It's the movie that we know as American Graffiti. The head of Universal, for some reason, takes a dislike to this movie. Even when they start doing test screenings where the audience loves the movie.
He hates it.
He hates it. It gets to the point where Francis Ford Coppola has to bluff with a checkbook saying, I will buy this movie from you right now. For him to finally agree to release in a theatrical release. Because he was just going to dump it. He wanted to dump it and have it be a TV, like, Sunday night movie. It
feels personal.
Yeah. And from Lucas's point of view, he's like, I have made a perfect movie. And one executive who has terrible taste is in the way of it. Then he makes Star Wars. And, you know, he gets resistance for that. People who are like, we don't get this. We don't know what you're doing. There's, you know. And Lucas starts, I think, thinking, I need to get myself into a position where I don't have executives telling me no when I have good ideas.
Which is, it is smart.
It's smart. And he does it. He does a thing that most people have never been able to accomplish, which is he gets himself into a position where he can effectively greenlight his own stuff. The problem is you have people, if you read about the making of those first couple of Star Wars movies, you have like Gary Kurtz, I think, was a guy who was like, you know, they're making A New Hope, they're making Empire Strikes Back. And there were people who were like, George, this isn't good, or I don't like this. You know, and famously in Empire Strikes Back, there was like, the I love you, I know scene. Mm-hmm. Lucas was like, it should just be I love you, I love you too.
I love you.
I know.
And everyone else was like, no, it's better. They came up with this when they were filming it on set.
It's much better. It's spontaneous.
And Lucas was like, it's going to get a laugh. And everyone's like, yeah.
Uh-huh.
It's going to get a laugh and be one of the greatest moments in all of Star Wars.
Yeah.
And by the time you get to Return of the Jedi, a lot of the people who would push back against stuff are no longer.
They're gone. Yeah.
I think Marsha Lucas, his first wife, was, I think, another person who was like, would sort of push back on certain ideas. And by the time you get to Jedi, they're no longer together. I think it gets hard. I think you see this with certain major figures in comedy that they have a couple of big hit movies and then suddenly their next movies aren't as good. And you think it's, oh, are they getting, everyone in the room is laughing at everything they do. So they don't even have honest, like testing ground for.
And I think there's a difference between being told no and having creative feedback because you want to stay sharp and you recognize that if you surround yourself constant, if the only people in the room when you're running your new set are your agents, you're never going to get actual feedback.
Yeah.
And I feel like maybe, so it's not so much saying no, but it is that there are other creative voices, including the actors, who you are simply not listening to because you are single-minded in your vision.
Yeah.
It's a
tricky thing because it could be a coincidence, but I don't think it is, that his best work happens in a period before he has complete control. Mm-hmm. And then there's a drop-off after that.
If you had to rank each movie, including Rogue One mm-hmm. and Solo,
yeah,
colon, A Star Wars Story,
yeah,
rank them.
Okay, yeah, I've done this.
Best to worst.
Let me think and make sure I'm doing this right. So number one would be Empire. That's an obvious pick, I think.
Well,
that's almost always the favorite.
My number one is Rogue One. But
Rogue One?
Yeah.
I rank Rogue One pretty high.
Well, we'll find out.
Let me see, because I think I did this recently, and I want to be consistent because I gave it some thought, and I think
It's okay if you change your mind. It can be fluid.
You're going to disagree with some of this. so I go with Empire, uh-huh. then A New Hope,
uh-huh.
and then Force Awakens.
Mm-hmm.
Then I have Return of the Jedi, Rogue One, Solo.
Okay.
Last Jedi.
Sure.
Ewoks, The Battle for Endor.
Oh.
No, Ewoks, Caravan of Courage.
That wasn't one.
Ewoks, Battle for Endor. These are the two TV movies that were made in the 80s featuring the Ewoks.
Don't miss The Ewok Adventure, now on video cassette from MGM UA Home Video.
Okay.
They were released theatrically in Europe.
Not even in the U.S.?
No.
So, like, in Germany, they were watching?
Literally, and I recommend people buy the Ewok movies on DVD as soon as you can, because I recently realized
as soon as you can?
Because we live
why in... Why is there a panic?
We live in an age where movies can disappear from streaming. I mean, these aren't even movies that are available on streaming, but movies become unavailable, and then if you don't have physical media, you might, not be able to find them.
I support that, actually.
They literally... I ordered these on DVD. They're on part of MGM's, like... DVD on demand service or whatever, and they came with a sticker that says the Star Wars movies they don't want you to see.
not the bad ones that they released everywhere. It's the little Ewok movies.
So Caravan of Courage, The Battle for Endor,
okay,
Phantom Menace.
They're better than Phantom.
Yes. Revenge of the Sith, Attack of the Clones.
Wow.
And I reversed those last two, actually, because sometimes I put Revenge of the Sith last because I feel like it's so overrated.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay, so I think Revenge of the Sith is very bad. However,
it's terrible.
The last 15 minutes, and I am including the battle.
No? Including the no?
I'm including, I have the high ground. I'm including all of that. But when he fucking puts that mask on and is Darth Vader, I still get chills. I generally agree with your rankings. I also am not a huge fan of the new films, but I put Rogue One much higher, I think, than you would, and I would put Solo much lower than you did. Well, I really didn't enjoy Solo.
Until you get to the Ewok movies, there's not a tremendous drop-off in terms of all of those first rankings. I wouldn't be terribly angry if someone mixed them around a little, because...
Sure.
Until you get to the Ewok movies, I don't consider there to be a big drop-off in quality.
Okay.
They're all competing at the same level. There's a big drop when you get to the Ewok movies, even though they're fun. These are basically children's movies made for NBC.
Yeah.
I then consider there to be another big drop before you get to The Phantom Menace, and then another significant drop from The Phantom Menace down to Attack of the Clones and Revenge of the Sith.
Yeah.
I include the Ewok movies there largely as a way of a demarcating point of, like, not only do I not like the prequels, there are actually two Star Wars movies no one even thinks about that I like better than the prequels.
You really want those movies to understand.
Yes. Yeah,
how far down this list they are. You're padding the top of the list.
Because I don't think it's fair to say, if you're doing a ranking where you go, like, Return of the Jedi and then Phantom Menace, you're like, no, there's a little bit of travel time if you want to get from one to the other,
Okay. I agree with that. I think generally we're on the same page.
Yeah.
Okay, we're going to pause right here. Take a quick moment because we are going to play, you and I, Connor, a little game called Is This a Sci-Fi? So this is a segment where I'm going to list a bunch of properties, franchises, films, TV shows, and you decide whether or not it qualifies as a sci-fi. What does that mean? I don't know. We're going to figure it out. So let's play Is This a Sci-Fi? So the first one is Mary Poppins.
Interesting. I mean...
The first, not the
Emily Blunt. The Returns.
Not the Returns. Not Return of the Mary Poppins.
It definitely counts as fantasy. I'm trying to think in terms of the pure science of it. I would tend to think first of it being fantasy, but I'm trying to think what kind of gear she uses at any point. She's got the umbrella.
Medicine, her sort of trick medicine.
Medicine, there's the chalk.
The chalk where she can transport into another world.
It's still, I don't think I see the science in it. So I think my impulse would be to say no, it definitely falls within sci-fi fantasy.
Yeah.
But it's closer to fantasy to me than sci-fi.
Okay. How about in honor of, I want to do all the Indiana Jones movies.
Yeah.
Raiders of the Lost Ark.
I don't think I mark any of the Indiana Jones movies as science fiction. Crystal Skull being the closest because they're aliens, but it still doesn't feel like, for me, it feels like science fiction needs to have an element that's like technological.
I agree. Or speculative in some way. I mean, speculative fiction where, there's no what if, really.
Or it's just one of those things where, like, I mean, even Star Wars, if it, you know, it's got so much hardware in it that it feels like science fiction.
Yes.
But he, like, Lucas will always kind of classify it as, like, it's space opera. There's not really, like, compared to Star Trek, which is definitely science fiction, Star Wars is much more like, we have a ship and it goes super fast. It's much more of like a child's version of science fiction. And when they do try to get science fiction-y, it's when it tends to stumble. Like, midi-chlorians would be like one example of them getting really trying to make a sci-fi move. And it not wearing that well. People liked it more when it was sort of like space religion and mumbo jumbo, you know?
I like that. That's one of my favorite parts of Rogue One, is that it fleshes out. There's more world building. It fleshes out exactly what...
Yes. I love that Rogue One is about essentially about a file transfer.
It's about upload. Data transfer. It's so good.
It's one of the things I like about Last Jedi is that it is essentially about working from home. It's about telecommuting. It's spoiler alert, but like the whole ending is just about like, what if you could work from home?
Are you talking about Obi-Wan?
I'm talking about Luke at the end when he
I was like, they're dead. They're not telecommuting.
No, he's in his home office. He's in his home. The big twist that it's like, you didn't drive here? No, I'm at home.
No.
This is a great connection.
Oh, The Last Jedi. Yes. I'm thinking of Return of the Jedi. The Last Jedi, is Luke. Yeah.
Well, because
kidding. This is a Google hang.
Coming a year after Rogue One, it really felt like they really are tying in modern technology things into this world, because Rogue One was very much like, we just got to get these files. Yeah. They're taking forever.
The download, like, the satellite's fucked. I don't know.
It's a Dropbox adventure.
Yeah.
And
sponsored by Dropbox.
Yeah. And Last Jedi is like the same thing, which is just like, I Skyped, you know?
Yeah. So, okay,
Luke Skypewalker.
Oh, no.
But considering that I just thought of that, that's
it's pretty
fine.
Good, yeah. It's, yeah. And how about, I have Muppets Take Manhattan, but I guess any of the Muppets films, do you feel that talking Muppet puppets are in any way fantasy or science fiction?
No, I don't think they are. Unless they're specifically doing genre like Pigs in Space or something like that. I don't even consider those fantasy films, because I feel like the reality of that world, it's our world and these are characters. And I mean, they're fantastical in the sense of Muppets, but I feel like they play it so real that it's not like you're watching like Lord of the Rings or something where you're seeing a whole different world. You're seeing our world with these Muppet characters. There's just one thing different, which is that people don't act like, which was actually kind of one of the weird things when they tried to reboot the Muppets, is they started referring to themselves and each other as Muppets.
They became conscious of the fact they're Muppets.
Yeah, whereas in the Henson years, it was always just like, you're a pig, you're a frog.
Yeah.
You know, and people just dealt with the fact that you were a talking pig and that was weird.
Yeah.
You know? No, I don't consider the Muppets sci-fi or fantasy unless they are doing sci-fi fantasy.
Okay, unless they venture into that genre. Well, that is all the time we have. They're throwing us out of the studio. We have to go. I want to thank Connor so much for being here and really encourage everybody listening, go see the George Lucas Talk Show. It's one of my favorite comedy shows in New York, and there's always amazing guests. Go see the Stepfathers, too. Go see Connor in his many, many pursuits. And hey, if you liked what you listened to, we've got a bunch more amazing guests coming up. So subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, be it your iTunes, be it your Spotify, be it the dark web, wherever you get your podcasts from, please review, rate, do all of the things that help us keep doing this. Bye.
Thank you.